Well, good morning or afternoon, everyone. Welcome once again to EMForum.org. I'm Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For our first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We need you to help us with excellent questions for our guests. Our topic today is Crisis Commons, which began as an idea to bring together people who are interested in leveraging technology and telecommunication systems to assist communities in times of crisis. Since 2009, Crisis Commons has coordinated crisis event responses such as Haiti, Chile, and Japan earthquakes, and floods in Thailand, Nashville, and Pakistan. We will also be hearing about the upcoming Crisis Camper Tour, possibly visiting a city near you this September. One of the tour objectives is to visit local emergency operations centers to talk to first responders about what they need from the technology community and how better to support their efforts, not just in the crisis, but also to prepare communities. But first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will be beginning with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. Let me point out, if you would like to capture a PDF of the slides, you may do so by clicking on the printer icon at the bottom right of your screen. However, we will be posting a copy of the slides later today as well. If you have any difficulty with live meeting, you may use the feedback drop-down menu at the top right to indicate that you need help, and then my associates, Ava G. Moore or Lori Weber, will try to assist you. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. We also ask you not to send any private messages to the speakers or moderator, as we will be busy. We are making a live meeting recording also, which should be available later this afternoon. And we are also now providing audio-only MP3 versions of our programs for your convenience, which you can access directly from our website or by subscribing to a podcast now available from the iTunes Store. The text transcript will be posted early next week. And if you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when those materials are ready. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's guest. Heather Blanchard is a co-founder of Crisis Commons, following 16 years of working for government, the private sector, and academia. This past spring, she was invited to testify before the Senate Homeland Security Committee on social media in the aftermath of disasters. And there is a link to that hearing on today's background page, as well as other relevant links. Pascal Schuback works for the King County, Washington Office of Emergency Management, where he is responsible for supporting technical operations and systems in the King County Emergency Coordination Center. Pascal previously worked in Oregon with several emergency management agencies in the Portland area. Again, please do see today's background page at your convenience for further biographical detail and related links. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. Pascal, I'll turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Perfect. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, or good afternoon to some of those on the East. First of all, thank you very much, Amy, for the intro and as well as for the support in getting this all set up. It's very well appreciated. It's a great application, a great program for us to be able to connect. And it helps us actually start our presentation off this morning a little bit with the ability for us to gather together as emergency managers and others in the continuity of business, emergency management business, through technology. In the past, this would have been very challenging to accomplish without this type of technology to collaborate. And with that, it brings us into the ability for us to move forward in using these technologies in our business and adapting them to our operational standards. And it kind of changes the game on how we do business. And that's a challenging change for many, both financially, both just for the change, and as well as just policy issues. And Crisis Commons is a good group of people and a good organization that helps build that capability and helps get us through the rough spots and find better ideas to do that. Since nobody's questioned anything back yet, I presume we're getting good sound. And I will continue forward and get my mouse to connect here and click. So quickly, oops, ago. Crisis Common actively, you know, is an organization that supports many different things. It supports the most important thing that it supports is a tool that we use called a crisis camp. And that crisis camp is that ability for us to harness together people either physically together in the same location or virtually throughout the world to support an incident or support a technical need or a challenge that's presented. And those challenges can be presented in multiple ways. It could be during an incident of saying, we need better abilities to visualize data, or we need to harness data that is out there that we don't see or know about and bring it together so that we can incorporate that information into a better response or better information to the public to support their needs and to provide them the services that they need. But at the same time, it also helps us build a community and a collaboration between many different sectors that are out there. It's not always just about public-private partnerships. It's about our communities. We have a great, at least in the United States, and I know some other countries, a great capability of our volunteers through the volunteer organizations, through VOAD, and the ability for us to use CERT teams. And we've put a lot of effort in training and collaborating together and connecting. But at the same time, we can do more. And a crisis camp gives us that ability of bringing those people together. Do you have to be a technology person to come to a crisis camp or participate in a crisis camp? No. You can do a lot of things without it. During some events, and we'll talk about some of those, we had people who were very afraid of computers, but they would sit down behind a computer and they could accomplish some things with tasks. And that was a great thing to see in some of the crisis camps that I was able to witness myself. But at the same time, one of the challenges, which I'm sure all of us have been following in the nation, is the debt crisis that we have. And that's putting a big hamper on our capabilities to provide public safety services because budgets are being cut. I know for my area in King County, we're the 13th or 14th largest county in the United States. We have a couple million people, and we have 39 cities and 180-plus special purpose districts to work with. That's a lot of work. It requires a lot of support and a lot of time, but at the same time, we're losing our budgets and getting cut from our grant funding all the way to our just normal budget funding to support. How do we accomplish those, our responsibilities and our requirements with doing it with less? Well, crisis camps also help us provide that ability for us to communicate with each other and find better ideas and going to people who might have experiences in logistics or experiences in public affairs or experience in building technology that can look at it and go, you know, we can do this with an open source tool, or we can do this with a pre-existing product that's already there and we can modify it rather than build something from scratch. And so it gives us a much larger identification pool. So that's a very nice and powerful thing to help build with that community. Some of the things that we've done in the past. One is Crisis Commons is a global footprint. We have conference calls sometimes with people all around the world, and we have to schedule them at different times to support that. But at the same time, we have the capability of the technology to communicate and work with people all around the world. I have worked with more people from around in Nairobi, in Japan, in New Zealand, in Poland, in Canada, all over the place that I never would have worked with as an emergency manager. And that's a great capability. So having that global footprint is a very powerful tool for us to help and overcome any of the challenges that we are faced with or needs that we need to support. During Haiti, which was one of our biggest and our forefront events, is we had over 65 events that happened in 8 countries, so 65 crisis camps. And that's a significant amount of number, and especially in a short period of time. It happened in over 30-plus cities, which was a great visual. But at the same time, not all cities were working by themselves. Me being in Seattle and working with the London crisis camp, the London team was taking projects on in the morning, and we would take over in the afternoon and just rotate through technology and that capability of just continuing their projects. None of us in Seattle wanted to wake up during the hours of London time, but we wanted to support that project, so we just kept on going while they were sleeping, and they took it over the next day for us afterwards. During Haiti, we had over 2,300 highly skilled volunteers that says up there that were helping us. That's a huge, huge response team. Any of you emergency managers out there, I'm sure, would love to have 2,300 members of your support team for your ECC or EOC. It would be a management challenge, but at the same time, wow, what a powerful workforce you'd be able to have. Well, that workforce is out there. We just need to harness it together and build that collaboration. At the same time, does your support team need to be local? Actually, I say no, it doesn't. You need to have some local presence, but at the same time, you can have it be global. And with that, you can globally respond to events, and that's what we're able to do. Some of them, like I said, we worked with Haiti, but at the same time, we did a lot with Christchurch. We actually took the site down to the Christchurch crisis camp, but because it was getting old and the information from the earthquake. But it was a very powerful tool, and we're using some software called Ushahidi as a mapping tool for crowdsourcing to help us identify issues that are out there from the public and for emergency responders so that others in the public and emergency responders could actually see it and get better coordinated information. It was a very powerful tool, some amazing numbers, and some statistics are out there. And if you have any of those, if you have more questions about that, our contact information is at the end, and we can help you find those. But not only was Christchurch a success, Japan, because it immediately happened after Christchurch, there's a lot of awareness, and there's still a lot of support. Communities come together drastically when there is a major event. And Crisis Commons not only wants to harness that, we want to also harness it when there's not a disaster, because the best time to prepare and respond is when you're not dealing with a disaster, but you're preparing for it. So some of the things we worked on as well, some of the floodings around the world and some of the tornadoes we've had in the Midwest. And at the same time, what's important for us to understand is in Crisis Commons is we can't replace emergency operations. You know, it is a local activity. It's a local event that takes place with a lot of time and preparedness and a lot of mandates that are regulated by governments, but it can support it. And we want to make sure people understand that Crisis Commons is not like a replacement of emergency management. It's not the new version of how to do emergency management. It's a collaboration. It's an incorporation of doing it together and using some of the tools that are new, but at the same time, using the tools that have been tried and true and proven from the past. And that's something that's important to make sure you know and understand, because we want people to understand that. As we keep going forward, some great things that Crisis Commons has done is Heather had the opportunity to testify in front of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. Very nerve-wracking, even for all of us watching. I'm sure she was more nervous as ever. But what a great opportunity for us to be recognized by such an organization and the government, and being able to know that we are making a difference and we're helping impact the change of the future of technology in emergency management and emergency response public safety. So that was one of our major events that was a very powerful tool. Alongside of her was, before just testified in front of her, was Craig Fugate, the administrator from FEMA. There was the president of the Red Cross, as well as someone from Google, and a local emergency manager, I believe, from North Dakota. And that was a great visual because it showed all the different dynamics. It showed private sector, it showed NGOs, it showed local government, and then it showed also this new world that we participate in this virtual technical community. And that's something that we're trying to help promote and educate people on. Some of the things that we learned as well are important to understand because it helps us direct the future and direct the change that needs to be made. Disasters can create opportunities for innovation. Obviously, during disasters, everyone in emergency management knows rules kind of change, and that provides opportunities for some of that change to take place because it needs to get done now and it needs to get done right away. So let's do what we need to do so we can get that assignment or mission task done. And that's an opportunity for us to help with that change. But at the same time, people are willing to look at solutions. They're willing to find, and during a crisis, you identify your problems. And unfortunately, those problems sometimes get identified in the wrong way, but at the same time, they're great for us to learn, and that's something that's important for us to go after and always look at the after-action reports. Disasters create, especially now with the mobile technology that's out there that's just phenomenal, is the rise of a crisis crowd. It's the public telling us what's going on. People flipping their, you know, the old flip cam or their iPhone out there and taking pictures and video and uploading it as YouTube reporters and providing that on-site situational awareness, which is a powerful tool, but we need to find out ways to better harness that information. But not only just harness and grab it and find it, but at the same time, let's try and train our public to better use it, to be better reporters, to tell us better information so we can actually share that information out to multiple agencies and multiple infrastructures. At the same time, disasters are very beneficial. They help strengthen programs. They help bring awareness. They help understand the importance of training and good leadership. But they also bring us the ability to, like I said, is bring that community and focusing on that community gathering and collaboration. The last bullet on the page is the same thing I mentioned before, is the importance of remembering that Crisis Commons is not a replacement or to be really viewed at as the ability for us to overtake what you guys are already doing, because no one can do that. It's a local. Disasters are local. Even if it's a major disaster, it happens locally in multiple little areas of that region that had that major disaster, because it's the community that exists there. It's the people that go to the same grocery store. It's the people who live in that neighborhood who check on their neighbors, who prepare and provide that opportunity to support themselves. It's that CERT team mentality or volunteer mentality that's important. And so that's one of the reasons why crisis camps are good to have before a disaster, is because it allows everybody to get inside. I work in a secured facility, so to get into our building, you got to go through some checks. Well, those checks are harder to get done during a disaster, but when it's on a Monday, it's quiet, it's a beautiful sunny day, come on down and we can get those checks done so we can build that credential and not have those small little roadblocks that turn into big roadblocks before us. As we go to the next slide and continue on some of the things we learned, like I mentioned, the importance of after actions. After actions in the technology world are kind of limited. People don't necessarily talk about it. A lot of times they refer to, and most after actions that I've ever seen always have the problem, we had issues with communications or interoperable communications, and they leave it at that. And one of the things that we really think that we need to help encourage more is the importance of documenting that better. And so some of the things that we're working on is how to help educate and provide awareness for the things that you should document that are challenges, so that teams of technical volunteers could help you in that. So if you're having problems communicating, is you're having problems communicating with the hardware, excuse me, or you're having problems communicating with workflow management or using alternative tools, or is it a ham radio issue, or is it just actually the technical issues of you don't have the ability to collect data, or there's too much data to collect, and those some of that. So we have the ability to help define standards and define practices. Incident management protocols, we go into that policy discussion, which I kind of want to stay away from today, but we all know we have a lot of policy issues. Everyone has their own version. It's an infinite number of policies out there, and some of them I don't know how we're created or why we're created, but unfortunately they were, so we have a mandate to follow them. So how does the technical volunteer community fit inside some of those policies? Because we've never had this type of a tool, and the policies were never designed for that. So how can we get into that process and helping change those policies and giving good advice and direction to be able to do so? And then, of course, prototypes of new tools and technology should probably not be deployed during a disaster, but unfortunately a lot of time that is how they're done. But how do we help implement that so they can be done beforehand? And like I said, crisis camps are a great way of doing it before a disaster, and having routine crisis camps or regular, you know, one or two of them a year in your community can help test and try those things, but also bring up new ideas in that environment. And obviously, as we all know, we need to use our tools every day. We have some systems here in my facility that we never use except for during a disaster, and those are our worst fears of when we have to turn it on. It's kind of like what Amy said at the beginning of the call, is it's always that challenge turning on the connecting of bridges. And we do that if, you know, Amy does this on a monthly basis or more, and she tests it. That's a good practice to do. Do we test our technology and our equipment? In my facility, our duty officers rotate every week, and one of their assignments every Tuesday morning and Wednesday mornings is to radio check, to check all the equipment. They go to the speaker phones, the conference bridges. They go to our video conference. They go to our secure phone. They check everything. They check it off to make sure things are working so that they can identify problems, and then I get a ticket to support and fix it and deal with whatever it is. That's good practices. Are we doing that? Do we have enough time to support that? Or do we need some of that volunteer support community to help us do that? Especially as technology is changing faster and faster, and it's challenging for us to maintain. What lies ahead? Boy, I love that line. There's so many things before us. The future's unknown. The future has so much opportunity, and we have the opportunity to go down a path and shape it and try and do stuff. So how can we do some things? What can we do? Well, we can do a lot of things. First of all, we need to socialize and incorporate this volunteer community of technology people. You know, there's this huge, like I mentioned, there's 2,300 plus people volunteered for the Haiti response. Were they all technical? No, but they all came together because technology got them together so that they didn't have to get to Haiti to do the work. You know, I've never been to Haiti, but I worked a lot for Haiti during those times. Why do I need to be in Haiti to do it and have more requirements and logistical needs to support myself in Haiti versus I'm at home. I can go to the grocery store. I have the luxury of having running, flushing water at home. I can still support and help people. And we need to harness that. We need to build that together. Not only just for our local, but for others. I know, and some of the emergency managers listening online know from me, if there's ever a problem in, say, Texas or in Denver and they need support, there's a handful of people who are more than willing, or I will probably actually reach out before they're being reached to offer support through small little short messages through Twitter or Facebook and saying, if you need anything, let us know. What can we do for you? And that's that community, and we need to continue to build that. One of those communities is an initiative that's moving on that Crisis Commons is supporting much. A lot is that social media for emergency management. The SMEM is the hashtag world on the Twitter initiative. Huge, and it's growing daily. There's some great players out there doing amazing things, and through this technology, we have the ability of knowing what's going on. So some of my colleagues and friends from Philadelphia to New Mexico, even just close as Vancouver, Washington, have the ability of sharing what they're doing, and I can actually know about it and go, hey, that's a great idea. Can we partner together? Can I use that in my area? And all of a sudden now we have more resources available to us because we all can share that information. That's part of that crowd. The next bullet is the crisis crowd. So we can do it in emergency management. Well, how about we do it during a disaster and before disaster and get our citizens who are more than willing to do stuff during it to give us information and help them. Have them become that volunteer community. There's over 2 million people, or we're right around 2 million people in King County. I'd love to have all 2 million of them giving me information during a disaster. I need a little more management support to do that, but, you know, I'll take as many of those as I can get. At the same time, community-based technology. A lot of technology now is becoming simplified enough that does every agency need to do it themselves, or can we bound together as a community in an emergency management and support systems and tools that don't require all of us to have our own independent version and save some money and our support time, but at the same time build sustainability, not just in financial capability, but in tech support. I'm one of the only few people in my office that do technical things. I'd like to take a vacation sometime and not have to worry about the office. If I know my counterpart in Seattle or in Bellevue, two of our major cities in our area, can support the tool while I'm gone for the region and not just for their agency, what a great capability for us having some continuity in our programs. Obviously, like I said, policy and technical standards are important. You know, supporting movements that build technology to communicate on an even scale. For example, EDXL is a tool, is a standard out there that's a very powerful standard for us. If you have any interest in EDXL, please ping me on the side, and I can give you plenty of information on that. But at the same time, if using our tools, we can move forward and do things together and build a common capability. Crisis Commons is about that. It's about getting people together and putting them in the room or putting them on a technical tool to support and go, what are you doing? Well, I'm doing this. Oh, hey, that's a great idea. Let us work together. Or can I ask you for more references or more Q&A or more questions? What a great capability, because we're a very small community locally in our local jurisdictions, but we're globally through technology. We are the globe. We have a huge capability. And it's great as knowing how emergency management happens in other countries and them asking us and us asking them how we do things. What a great tool and what a great capability. Crisis Commons helps us get to that. So now I'm going to talk a little bit more about what I do locally. So Heather does a lot of Crisis Commons stuff globally. I mean, she's on the global scale, and I help participate with that as much as possible. But at the same time, I do a lot of the focus work on crisis camps for the Seattle area and the whole Puget Sound area, which is a blast because we have some great organizations in our backyard. I mean, Microsoft's home is here. We have a big Google presence. We have Adobe. We have Amazon. We have all sorts of organizations and private sectors out there who are willing to support, who love technology. I mean, you see mobile phones everywhere around here. You see little things. I mean, our state Department of Transportation is one of the highest Department of Transportation users on social media because they broadcast everything. I know exactly when a traffic accident happens because they post it on my Twitter feed, and I get it. It's great. We have that capability. Some areas in the United States and around the world don't have that luxury. So Crisis Camp Seattle tries to work as much as we can to help not just support what we need, but supporting a greater community, a global community. One of the things we do is we collaborate a lot with a group that's from here, is Geeks Without Bounds. You can go to their website, gwob.org, great organization, some great people that support wonderful tools, and not just for emergency management. They do a lot of other outside of the area, but we cross and help each other out a lot. So I want to make sure that, please check them out. It's a great tool and a great opportunity. But some of the things that we've done at Crisis Camp Seattle for emergency management focused are some powerful tools, and I'm going to just quickly give you some backing down on it, and I will let it go in the Q&A. You can ask more. You can always ask me afterwards, too. So one of them that's really involved that I work for part of my job as well as part of the community is the SARA application. It's for Situation Awareness and Rapid Assessment application. We have this huge need to go out and grab information during a disaster quickly, and it's normally from a trusted source, like a firefighter or public works or a police officer, giving us information like the I-90 bridge, which is a huge floating bridge and a huge, huge key infrastructure part to our region in Seattle. Is it floating still, or is it on the bottom and sank on the bottom of Lake Washington? How does that come through and that capability for us to go? So the Situation Awareness and Rapid Assessment application is a web-based tool, but as well as it is a mobile application that can live on an iPhone soon, but it lives on an Android device now, and you can download it and test it. Just to let you know, if you do try and find it right now, it is a beta version, and it has a couple issues and some of that capability for us. Sorry, we're doing one of our secure phones is being checked right now by our duty officers, so I apologize for the background noise. Another application is a MADPUB. It's a mobile assessment of damage. How many of you have ever been in a disaster for yourself and actually as one of the survivors and had to fill out any of the paperwork that you need to get a hold of FEMA? FEMA has been trying really hard in changing that and building better tools and capabilities. Well, MADPUB, we can help with that. MADPUB was a project that we did last year that we wanted to start streamlining the workflow so that not only are you filling out paperwork to the feds, but you're filling it to the locals, emergency management, to the county, and to the state emergency managers. What a great capability if we can streamline all that and share information better. The last one is one that I'm working on right now that is kind of under the radar still, but I have no problem releasing it out because you won't get to the website, but the website's blocked for right now. But recoverywashington.org is the ability for us to build a damage and recovery information mapping tool that's a crowdsourced map. Same thing what we did for Christchurch and what's been done for Japan and Haiti and for Chile, for Pakistani floods, for the tornadoes. It's a huge capability for us. What we're trying to do is not deploy it during a disaster. We're trying to deploy it before the disaster and making it a tool that is used on a daily basis, not just for disaster information, but tell us where a pothole is so you can give us that information. Tell us where a street light is out or where there's graffiti. And using those departments on a daily basis, but during a disaster, everyone is aware. So if you have more information on that, but that one's a little rough because we're about ready to release it and get it ready for streamlining. But one of the nice things about that project is King County and the City of Renton are two of the pilots, and we're testing it, but we're not doing it for ourselves. We're taking the mentality like Crisis Commons is trying to educate, is we're doing it for the whole state because it's not that hard for us to let the technology do the work because the technology already works globally. The SARA application, it can take reports in your GPS locations from anywhere around the world because that's how it works. And then we can, on the back end, separate the data necessary where it needs to go. So some of the capabilities. Quickly, too, because I know I'm running out a little bit of time, and I have just a couple more slides left, is let's talk about the Crisis Camp Tour. This is a pilot tour for us to be able to test and see. And what we're going to be focusing on is in the Southwest and some of the bigger cities, down in L.A., Phoenix, New Mexico, and some of the capabilities where we've seen some great success with SMEM, with crisis camps, and a community. And so we're going to be having crisis camp events and or kind of bar camps, depending on what agency we're with. But it's really to help, like I said, build those technology and community bridges together and get people working together and build better tools. Have them meet together, and us as Crisis Camp and Crisis Commons be the ones that bring together in a neutral party and go and forget whatever happened in the past if something has happened. Let's look forward to the future, and let's look at the cool things we can do together. And I say cool as in not just technology, but cool new innovative things that can help change the way we prepare, we respond, we recover, and to disasters and working for communities and looking forward to that. Let's change and let's move forward. At the same time, one of the things that I want to do personally, but it's also a great thing for us to do with Crisis Commons in that way, is what is out there? Who's using what? What do we really, do we need to build better standards? Is there standards for emergency operations centers and command centers and coordination centers to have certain standards of technology? Should we make sure that they have solid internet connections or redundant internet connections? Should they have the ability to use Twitter or Facebook or even video and web conferencing like we're doing today? What should we have as technology as it's changing so fast and grant funding is limited? What can we move forward to and what should we have that next level? There's always been a standard for EOCs on you should have a desk, a phone, and a computer and a chair for ESFs or ICS positions. Well, let's expand that to the technology side and making sure we're providing the tools and we can go together with the results of the survey and say, well, in order for us to meet this technology, we've looked at the surveys, we've gotten information, we need this type of funding to help support that. So, hey, feds, what kind of support can you do to help us provide better tools to respond to our communities and provide better customer service as well as better response? So that Crisis Camp tour is going to be happening later this month. It's going to be towards the end of the September for closing out National Preparedness Month. We're working on some of those details, and we're actually having one of our first conference calls this afternoon, evening for some, and getting that all together. But you can find more information on that, too, as it comes out on the Crisis Commons website. Last bit, the tour details, like I was just talking about some of the things, but just best practices, situational awareness, recovery tools, the opportunities from data sources, social media, implementation roles, some of the things that we're going to be talking about. Huge capabilities, huge opportunities. If you have any suggestions or questions about it, please feel free to ping either Heather or myself or both or the community, and people can help answer those, and a lot of us are willing to help. I apologize if I talk fast. That's just me, but I wanted to just say thank you to everybody for letting us have this opportunity to talk to you and share a little about what Crisis Commons does and the cool things we can help with, but at the same time, the vision that can be before us that we can harness together and build better communities, friendships, and foundations so that when any of us have a disaster, we know we have not just our local teams to build off of and to rely on, but we have this huge community that's global that's willing to support us. And that's a great opportunity. It's fun. It's exciting. But at the same time, we all know we are doing something phenomenal. We are helping people who we wouldn't be able to have helped in the past, but we're helping them now. So I will let Heather speak a little bit if she needs to. She's been traveling, so she's a little, I'm not sure where she's at today, but Heather, if you want to say anything, you're welcome to. If not, we'll go to Q&A and let Amy control that mechanism.
Pascal, thank you so much. I think that, to be honest, I mean, that you really covered it quite well, and I just want to echo the gratitude that we have for the AM Forum for having us, and then for all of you I know a lot of you have been very supportive of our efforts, and I just kind of wanted to underscore that Crisis Commons is an all-volunteer community. People are, providing their time when they can. Like Pascal said, this is definitely not a replacement at all. And we like to kind of think of it as a place of innovation. Crisis Camp is really kind of an impromptu space where people can just, anyone, it's free. It's a free concept of bringing people together. Anyone can participate. And we really think that's a powerful tool. And what it's really meant to do is to connect all of the technology communities in a local area and bring together emergency management. So in any given town, as Pascal said, there could be probably hundreds of technology groups that are in that local town. And every town has a Department of Computer Science. And we really feel that if you connect those resources, and if you begin talking before the event, there really could be some valuable support during the event, that could provide some kind of surge capacity. Because when I worked at DHS for 7 years before I left to do this, and part of that was that I understand like what it's like to be in an EOC, and Pascal does too, and a lot of people that. Working at Crisis Commons as a volunteer activity, know what it's like, and what we want to do is figure out a way and have those discussions now of how can technology volunteers be able to support the needs of emergency management during these events? And then how can we create mutual assistance networks that really kind of reinforce that? For example, you know, right now I'm in Los Angeles, and if something happened in L.A., perhaps the crisis camp in L.A. may not be able to participate, but, you know, San Diego, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco could provide mutual assistance, very similar to Compact, you know. So it's kind of getting into that kind of forward thinking of how these groups not only can work together at the local level, but start building the bridges to adjoining jurisdictions and then even going further than that. And so I think that what we're really seeing, this is just in its infancy, to be honest. And there's so many things that we think that it could do. One of the things I've been trying to work on is, and I'm sure as you all know, is if there isn't a connection to the EOC, oftentimes people don't see the support that could happen. In the worst time, you know, of course, to kind of show up on the scene during a disaster is in the middle of the disaster, and you don't want, you know, 2,500 volunteers showing up and showing up not only physically but virtually, and being able to kind of, you know, provide them some productive projects that they could be helping the response system with. So I think that one of the things that we're very concerned about, but we want to work very closely and to kind of help guide the development of, is that connectivity between the technology volunteer communities that already exist that are out there and local emergency management. So kind of to put it in plain language, how does this connect? And right now, like, there isn't a formal connection mechanism. You know, is it ESF2? Is it ESF6? Do you have a liaison of planning? I mean, right now, like, we kind of hear that it's there's no formal mechanism, and it's very difficult to figure out where that would sit. And a lot of EOCs, there's geospatial. I mean, what could we be working with those since we're doing mapping? So there's not only what we have seen is that during every crisis, there will be people that will gather together, self-organize, and will kind of show up. What we really would love to see happen is that their efforts and their time and energy, which are very valuable, can be used for productive use, and there can be that local connectivity that happens before the disaster, those business cards are exchanged, and you're able to really be able to kind of say, you know, if you're sitting in the EOC, hey, if you guys could be monitoring Twitter, can you tell me what, you know, are there any more hashtags that are out there? Are there things that are popping up that aren't in this report? Can you guys do kind of a visualization matrix? There's all kinds of things that can really happen. And I also just want to kind of give two more things. Is that these volunteers are very skilled. In their day job, they are, I mean, these guys are their senior vice presidents. They are IT, the directors of IT. These are people that have a lot of skills. We have a lot of people that have emergency management background. So, you know, kind of thinking that these are people that may not have the skills that are needed, there's so many people that have those skills and want to offer them. The question is, of course, as any volunteer is like, how do you put that to productive use? And so we really want to strive to do that. And I really encourage you to look at the testimony that if you go to crisiscommons.org and you hit our blog, you'll see a blog post about participatory crisis management. And that's really where that we have several documents that we wrote for Congress, and we talk about that kind of the importance of that connectivity beforehand. And it's not just, you know, again, you'll see that the community contributed to the development of that those thoughts, and a lot of that, you know, comes from, in a way, a lot of you. So we really, there's a lot of really great opportunities to explore this. We want to do this together. We're all about collaboration, and that's really, you know, I think I'll just leave it there. I just wanted to kind of clarify that, again, we're an all-volunteer community, and we really want to kind of work in to support emergency management, and we want to find productive ways to engage before the disaster. And so that's something that we really think is important. Pascal and I are an email away. We'd be more than happy to answer your questions now and then also follow up with any questions you may have later.
Great. Thank you so much, Heather, and thank you, Pascal. That was a terrific overview. We will go ahead and give our audience an opportunity to chime in here and ask some questions. And to do that, you just click on Q&A from the top menu. Then you'll type in the top half of the box that opens up and click on Ask. Now, there is a hand-raising feature there, but we do not use that. When you do click on Ask, your comment will go or question will go to an administration panel. I will announce who the question is from and read it aloud, and then our guest will respond via the conference bridge. And then I'll type in a little text, okay, and that will release the text of the question to the Q&A box. Please note you are only able to submit one question or comment at a time. You know, that's just the way our technology works here. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And if you want to direct your question to either Heather or Pascal by name, you can do that. We are ready to begin now, so please go ahead and enter your comment or question at any time. Now, to start off, I do have a comment from Tim Great, who says, I have been aware of Crisis Commons for a long time as Evatech, that's his company that has now merged with SE Solutions. We work with nations, practitioners to drive EDXL requirements. That's the OASIS standards, set of standards that Pascal referred to a little bit earlier. And he says they have volunteered quite a bit in the past. Okay, now let's see. We have let me get back to that. Mark Clements, good question. He asks, how do emergency management agencies connect or engage with Crisis Commons?
So I can start out with this one, and you know, as Heather said, you know, we are a volunteer organization, so we don't have official bat signals yet, so you can't put that big spotlight in the sky and ask for Batman and Crisis Commons. What's powerful about the tool of technology is we can hear about disasters. You know, if it's a disaster, we hear about it. So obviously then the rumor mill, and we don't, it's not really the rumor, but you know, people start talking about it, and you start going, oh wait, I know that person, Mark. Oh yeah, he's in this city, and you know, you start connecting, and you use your contacts and your social capital to connect with people, and you start figuring it out. But at the same time, we have an email address, we have a Twitter feed, we have a Twitter or a Facebook page that you can put out there that a lot of us are monitoring and keeping an eye on, and going, you know, put the call out. Don't put it in the bat signal into the sky, but just put out in the internet or the Twitterverse or Facebook world, and say, hey, you know, we've got a question and we've got a need. Could you guys help us with this? Or, hey, we just had a big earthquake and we could use some help. And, you know, be descriptive. Tell us what you need. Tell us what you're looking for. And we'll connect people together and put it out to the community and have them ask, you know, say, anybody can help with this? You know, we have to remind ourselves that sometimes volunteerism is dependent on schedules of life and things, but at the same time, as we build a bigger community, that means there's more people who might not be all busy at the same time. So my recommendation to get a hold of us is, you know, we have the webpage, we have the email, and the social media channels. Ping us anytime, and we'll do what we can.
Yeah, and just to kind of go further, is that the first thing you really want to do is that you want to build a local capacity. And I think that, you know, for a while, like, people have kind of you know, like Pascal was saying, it's just kind of gone to the community. But I really think that if you live in wherever that town that you are in, is that we can give you tips and pair you with a mentor, a crisis camp organizer, that can help you develop your own crisis camp community in your local area. I can't emphasize that enough. That, I mean, you can come to the global community, but the first thing you want to do is you want to kind of connect what you have there. It's just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like preparedness. You have to prepare yourself first before you can go out there and prepare the community. And so we have the same attitude at Crisis Commons, is that, you know, we really want to see people engaging their local community first. And to be honest with you, if you're an emergency manager and you put out the call that you want to kind of talk to the technology community in your town, that is actually, for us, that's the best case example. Because usually what's happening is that people on the outside of emergency management that care are creating the camp themselves. And often they're trying to, in a way, you know, pull at the coattails of emergency management and say, hey, can you please come to my camp? So it is very powerful for emergency management to say, I want to create a crisis camp in my town, and you're just using this open platform. And to be honest, it's free, it's easy, and we can provide mentors that can help you do it. I know Pascal would be more than happy to help. I've created crisis camps in Washington, D.C. We have people all over the country. The other thing is that we do have a list of people that have expressed interest from all over the world, and we can call together that list. So, like, if you live in Des Moines, and, you know, we can put out a call to our communities, like anyone in Des Moines interested in creating a crisis camp, we put those people together with you, and you have your first, in a way, kernel of people that can begin building that local camp. But that's the first step. And the second step is coming to the community if there is a specific need. But, again, as Pascal said, it is a volunteer group, and, you know, is that the interest of the volunteers? But I really think that the strongest interest you will ever have is at the local level.
All right. We have a question from G. Smith who asks, how do you incorporate the data collected from volunteers into the data collected by officials in order to develop a common operational picture?
Hey, Pascal, you met.
I can take that one. So one of the challenges is, you know, there's always that fear perception of trusted agent versus non-trusted agents, and I've been breaking down that barrier. One of the things that we're trying to do, like with the SARA application, is it's one application that can be used by both. And there's measures inside the application, such as when you submit, it grabs and tells me your common information off your phone, tells me your phone number. And if your phone number is in my directory, that you physically, Mr. Smith, I don't know your first name, G. Smith, is at a public works supervisor, and you're in my directory as a public works supervisor, I can take that as a trusted source rather than untrusted source. But at the same time, when you go to untrusted, think of it this way in crowdsourcing, in the ways way back when law enforcement would go to a crime scene and survey all the people and get testimony statements from all the people that surround the yellow tape. Well, that's a form of crowdsourcing. They're going around getting information. They look at it, and they communicate with each other, collaborate, and go, well, 80% of the crowd is saying that the person with the hoodie in the back corner did it. Well, that's how trusted information becomes trusted, is through the process of crowdsourcing. And at the same time, if you get 50 pictures through email, Twitter, Facebook of the I-90 bridge no longer there, do you still need to send a state trooper or a public works person to go and officially call you on the radio and saying, no, it's not there? So we've never had that capability and that kind of number, those kind of reporting numbers of information coming back to us so fast. And one of the things that people have known about Twitter is it's self-correcting a lot of times. Because if you say something wrong, someone's going to correct you. And then it gets republished and republished and republished. So how do we collect that? At the same time, in our common operating picture that we're building here in the region, we have the ability of identifying as if it's a trusted source or an untrusted source, and then convert it to a trusted source. So if all of a sudden, Mr. Smith, you're a person that has been giving me trusted information for 2 days in a row, and I initiate contact with you, I might put you in my trusted category. So a lot of those decisions are based on the fly at the moment during the disaster or an incident that we're dealing with. But you have ways to measure and calculate and use both that information. But, you know, if you're a logistics person and you get the bridge out notification from an untrusted source and you have 50 of them, that might change your course of action on how you provide logistics services for a region. So, but if you have more questions about the common operating picture, feel free to send me an email because we've been working on that heavily here.
Very good.
Next question.
I've got a kind of a long comment here from William Miller. I'm not going to go ahead and read it. I'm just going to go ahead and release the text of it. He's also addressing the issue of trusted source and is making a suggestion in terms of a third-party validation of trusted source.
I can talk a little bit about trusted source, not trusted source. So I think that if you look at information in a few different ways, the first thing is that right now, however your EOC is configured, how are you pulling information from the public? And there's several different layers of information. So if you were to pull information from the public, however you would do it, that is just one piece of information that you are going to use that you could use. You don't even have to use it. But the fact is that the information is there. You can aggregate it. You can pull it. It's public. It's open. You know, the fact that if you don't pull that information, you're actually operating in a blind spot in your situational awareness. I mean, that's just a fact. And so at this point, it's like you have to pull it. So you make sure that you're able to kind of have those different pieces of information. Do you make, like, operational decisions from it? No. I mean, because you should have your, you know, official sources. But, again, as Pascal was saying, if 50 people and the news crew is sitting there saying that this is what's happening, you know, you're going to believe it. And the other thing is, if you look at news media, I mean, what is, in some sense, what's the difference? So I really think that that's an interesting point. And I'll give you kind of a little story that I told during the Red Cross Data Summit. And I also shared some perspectives of trusted and untrusted information in the congressional testimony. I was in San Francisco a few years ago, and my rental car got busted. Like, they busted my driver's side window overnight. And I go out there and I call the city and I said, you know, what should I do? I'm like, you know, police gonna come out and do stuff. They're like, oh no, no one's gonna come out. You just go ahead and I can file a report here, or you can just report it online. Okay, so this is a crime that has been committed, and I am providing a police, like, information for a police report. That police report is taken and used by an insurance company to do a claim. Is that verified information? Nobody came out and said and took a picture or took a video. And so if you look at it like that, and every day law enforcement uses unverified information every day. So during a disaster, to be honest, you don't have time to verify all these pieces of information. What you need to do is that's going to be the best information you have, and it's not there explicitly for you to make a decision. You know, no emergency manager is going to make a decision on operational methods based purely just on public information. However, that public information is an added piece of operational awareness that they may need to make sure to make that decision. So it's one piece. It's not the piece. And I think that if if you get wrapped up in the, we got to verify if this information is true, you're going to lose, well, number one, if that's impossible in a disaster. And then number two is you're going to lose time, and if you don't use it at all, you're going to have a blind spot in your situational awareness.
Thank you. We are kind of getting short on time here, and we do have a few more questions we'd like to get to. If we do not get to all of them, again, we'll get that contact information back up, and you please feel free to follow up with Heather and Pascal. I've got a question from Gary Tim, and Pascal, perhaps you'll take this. He asks, how do you use EDXL, and how will you be promoting EDXL on the Crisis Camp Road Tour?
It's a great question, Gary. So two things. One, how I use EDXL on a daily basis is we've identified and accepted, and it's pretty much our policy, that all data transactions happen in the EDXL format. So whenever we exchange information in between any of our information systems, it will be used the EDXL process. We're going to be updating it to 2.0 as it just got released, but we're establishing that standard. So within our web EOCs in the region, within our SharePoint systems, within our logistics systems, we are in our emergency communication systems, everything is going to be using those EDXL standards and the standard based to that. Obviously, CAP is a little different there, but, you know, we're trying to establish for incident command, we have those commonalities. You know, it's the same thing every time. So then you can use whatever system you, computer system or software you want on your end, as long as it coordinates with EDXL, then we don't have to worry about other, you know, issues with in the middle. For the road trip, that's the same thing that I want to promote, is that ability for us to establish standards that are standards that do not affect how we operate, in the sense that they do not say you must do things this way by clicking this button, this button, this button. EDXL, and I'm sure you know this where others may not, is EDXL is just a standard on the back end that makes sure data can be exchanged in a format. So the way I describe it to some of my elected officials is think of all the different plugs that we have around the world for electricity. If we could all standardize that, or all the phone jacks, I have an iPhone, I have an Android, I have two different car chargers in my car for both phones because they don't have a standard. It still does what I need to do, but I need to, you know, we need to unify it so that way if I have a firefighter come in who needs to charge his phone, I don't need to have five different phone cables in my car to provide that support. So using EDXL as a tool to identify a standard for us to communicate, that's one of the biggest things that I'm going to be sharing. Next question.
Yes, thanks. I'm going to release a couple of these that are comments. We have, and folks can just review them in the Q&A panel. We have one from Alex Rose, and he wants to echo Heather's point regarding the value of nurturing these communities at the local level. Have a question from follow-on about your tour. Ava Jean asks, for the stops on your upcoming tour, what type of advanced preparation is being done with volunteers in those localities? What type of participation do you expect?
So good question, and I just saw another quick question about EDXL, and Isabel, I can offline forward you the direction where you need to go to learn about EDXL, but it's too much for this conversation. As for the road tour, Abedin, some of the things that we're doing for the Crisis Commons tours, one, we're using the existing communities, and I'll give you a good example of Jeff Phillips in Los Ranchos, New Mexico. He has an existing community and a virtual support team inside his area that's statewide or, you know, I'm, you know, the square state of New Mexico, but it provides him the ability to connect with all of his emergency managers and his community supporters and his technical people, and he's creating his bar camp, crisis camp for the day. And it's promoted within all his communities that he works with, and I believe at the same time with the media as well, to get the public involved, to get them the community, like we try and practice and preach, is that ability for us to harness everyone together. So he has a full day planned, and tonight I'll get more information exactly of what he has on his agenda. But what we are is we're that agent that gets to come into town and help him create that in the sense of there's a group of people coming into town to talk about these technology tools. We want all of you there because it's going to help build that community. And we're kind of the reason why it gives him the reason to have an event, to make it bring awareness so that we're the outsiders. We're here. It's a special event that we want to help promote, and we want to build his community. So I look at it more as what he needs, we will support so that we can build his community up for his community. Because the stops on the tour are different for every city. Los Angeles, totally different than what Santa Barbara would do because they're two separate communities. So by going to the local people or contacts and asking them, what do you guys need to have a camp or a bar camp or a crisis camp, how can we help you build? Because you guys know better what your community needs than us on the tour. And so we're integrating with those people locally on the ground.
I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Hopefully you will be publishing your tour schedule later on your site when you've got that more nailed down, Pascal.
We will be. And it'll be coming out fairly shortly, please.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Heather and Pascal. We do appreciate you taking the time to be with us today to share this information and certainly wish you continuing success and growth with your future efforts.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Thank you.
Again, the audio and video recording should be available later this afternoon. And if you're not on our mailing list and would like to get notices of future sessions and availability of the materials after the programs, just go to our homepage to subscribe. Now, before you all run off, please take a moment to do our little rating and review form. And the rating is just relevance and usefulness of it. And but we are interested in your comments. And if you have additional questions, you might put them in there. Now, if your organization is interested in becoming an EIP partner, there's a link on our homepage, also in your email announcements. And then finally, our next program will take place Wednesday, August 24th. And then just please watch for our announcement and plan to be with us then. Until next time, thanks to everyone for participating today. Thanks for the great questions. We really do appreciate your participation. Have a great afternoon. We're adjourned.